Good afternoon. So, last time, we talked about some logistics issues, and talked about sort of malware in a very general sense. We mentioned some sort of categorizations of malware, including what malware in general was. I had this sort of definition of evil software, software that's meant to do something bad, typically, well, with something that the person running it would definitely really not want. And we talked about some particular types, including perhaps the most widely known type and historically the most prevalent type, though that's no longer true, of viruses, which are the software that self-replicates by embedding itself into legitimate executables or documents. And also the related category that we called worms, of self-replicating programs that are not embedded into some other executable or document. So these are both self-replicating. And we also mentioned Trojans, which are good-looking software that's actually evil. For example, something that pretends to be an installer for some software, but really install, you know, and maybe actually installs that software, but also installs something else. This is sort of deception, and this is distinguished from worms because, you know, while there's something which kind of spreads naturally, it's not the case that the software itself is being copied onto, the software itself is copying itself onto its victim machines. It's that someone is deliberately installing it because they think it's some legitimate or at least useful piece of software. We also spent a bunch of time talking about sort of what malware typically tries to do. And I mentioned probably the most prominent category are people trying to make money. So typical examples of so-called cybercrime. And there are also, of course, other motivations, but those are, you know, less common, especially if you aren't considering sort of nation-state attacks. So we mentioned sort of fraud. So I mentioned the idea of ad fraud, that people want to scam the ad companies, and having extra machines to do that is a way of doing that. People who want to scam users by saying, oh, we'll get rid of this virus if you buy our antivirus software, which really just turns off the malicious software that you have installed, but doesn't actually do anything about anything else. Using it for spying, for getting financial info, mentioned sort of non-profit, or typically not-profit motivations of stalking or nation-state espionage, which I misspelled. Ransomware, sort of one of the more destructive and unfortunately apparently relatively profitable mechanisms of monetizing malware. And adware, this is injecting ads, so that's a way to make ads where there weren't any as a way to make money. And just taking CPU and network resources to do other things, which this last one has the advantage of the user doesn't really notice as much as these other cases. Well, as much as these other cases, fraud is kind of a case of this, for things like denial of service attacks on other people or cryptocurrency mining. All these ways that make money. And you mentioned that a reason why in the real world, if you're combating malware, you might be concerned about this is that there are other ways of attacking sort of the malware ecosystem by looking at ways of stopping the ways that people make money. That if they're installing malware to do ad fraud, to click on ads and pretend that a user did it, well, if you can better detect that and make that less profitable, you can probably lower the amount of malware out there without actually doing any actual malware analysis. If you can make it so taking financial info is not so useful because, you know, maybe you need a second authentication factor to actually do anything with it, then you that should make that type of malware less prominent because, well, it's just harder to make money off it. So those things that are worth thinking about. It's not things we're going to talk about much in this course, just because that's not our focus, but I wanted to mention it because, well, it's quite interesting sort of what we can glean about sort of the ecosystem and the economics of malware, and because if you had a job combating this in, say, law enforcement, this is probably a big avenue where you'd want to go, is looking at not, you know, how do I look at this piece, this malicious piece of software and figure out who's doing it, but looking at the other way of how are they making money off this, where is that money going? So questions about things we talked about last time, including logistics, which I don't have written on here. Okay, I'm not seeing anything. So, as a last piece of logistics, last time I mentioned we'd have weekly quizzes, and I promised I'd do a demo for those of you who haven't seen it. So, we have a quiz site, which is linked. Well, the quiz site looks like this. It's linked from the here on our course website. Wait, am I not? My God, I am not sharing my. Did I stop sharing this window? I'm just not sharing this window. No, I am sharing this window. Okay. I don't see a outline of what I'm sharing. Okay. Interesting. So hopefully, if you can't see a browser window, you're going to tell me. Okay. So there's just no green outline apparently right now. Okay, so this is a demo site for the quizzes. So you'll go choose the quiz you're taking. It has an open and close time. I have it on the real quiz site opening in the evening, so I have time to revise the quiz based on what actually happens in lecture. And there's a close time, which is set, in this case, to a bit before lecture, because I would prefer you not doing the quiz during lecture. So when you open it, we'll ask if you really want to view it, and you'll get a site. You can answer questions, you can select things. The box around the question will turn green when your answer is recorded. It will be yellow when it's not yet. It should be recorded if you change your focus to another control for these text input boxes. And immediately when you do this, if it stays yellow, that means you have some sort of network problem or you got logged out of NetBadge and your answer is not recorded. There is a space on each of these questions for some comments. You can write something there. And we will eventually read it. Not immediately, but eventually. And we will take it into account if it changes whether we should give you credit for the question or not. When the quizzes are closed, they'll be graded based on the key we have. So here's an example of the quiz being graded. These are the options I selected previously for this quiz here. The ones with this mark here are correct answers. And these percentages here are the percentage of students who selected those answers. And we can see here an example of if you wrote a comment like this, eventually there will be feedback for it. When the quiz closes at 3:15 p.m. on Monday, that obviously will not have happened because we will actually have to have some human look at your answer and do something with it. I expect that will take about a week, and that might change the score up here. That's the quiz system. Also, the overall grades are shown here and the class mean. So questions about how this works.
I have one question.
Yeah.
When we open the quiz, like, is it just once we open it, we can't retake it, or like, is it open until the time it closes?
Okay, so the question is, like, when I open the quiz, can I, you know, when can I change my answers? So you can go back anytime before the quiz closes, and you'll see your answer should still be there. This is also a way you can check if you're not sure whether your answers got to the server or not. You can reload the quiz. Okay. And you can keep revising your answer until the close time. And we're not going to have any time limits on the quiz. The software I'm using supports it. So if you've taken certain other classes, perhaps with Luther Chakanovich, you may have seen it used in that mode, but that is not a feature I'm going to use. So it's all, you can take the quiz until it closes and revise your answers until it closes. On the note of retaking things, because you'll see sort of these answers here after the quiz closes, and everyone can see that. I generally cannot accept late quizzes because the answers have been released publicly. Also, people might ask about quiz questions during the lecture, and I would like to be able to discuss them. So if for some reason you can't take a quiz, like you're sick or something, probably we'll make some other sort of arrangement and you should email me. Or make a private question on Piazza if you have that sort of scenario. But it's unlikely I'll be able to give an extension. We'll probably find something else if you have a case where that makes sense. Okay, other questions about quizzes? Okay. So that. Okay. So we talked about types of malware, and we're going to be mostly looking at malware that, and also exploits that deal with sort of assembly and machine code. So we're going to want to talk about assembly. You theoretically know assembly from 2150. In practice, we probably should do some review, and we're going to also talk about some things that are going to come up because we're going to look at real programs and need to figure things out that, you know, maybe didn't come up in 2150 or 3330 if you took it, or other classes where you may have used assembly. We're going to be using x86-64 assembly in this course. That's not because I think it's better or anything. It's just because you're most likely to have used it before, and we can get you access to that sort of environment most easily, most likely. And we're going to mention history a bit, which I think is useful to talk about with this assembly, because we're going to, for the purposes of history, be looking at some really old x86 assembly, some from some 16-bit x86 assembly, probably next Monday. And because it also explains a bunch of weird things going on in both the assembly language and the encoding. And we're going to talk a bit about the encoding because when we're talking about exploiting things like memory mismanagement, we want to do things that involve machine code. So we need to understand a little bit about what the machine code looks like. So we're going to try to get to enough detail where we can work with that when we need to. We're not going to be experts on using it, but I want you to know enough that, like, with the manuals, we can figure it out. And on that note, both Intel and AMD, who are basically the authors of 64-bit x86, the history is that AMD made a 64-bit extension to x86, which they called AMD64. Intel at the time thought, 64-bit's cool, we're going to make a new instruction set for that that's called Itanium. you probably have never used an Itanium machine, and that tells you what happened to Intel's instruction set. It's very ambitious. It's a very interesting instruction set that you are never likely to use. You might have some Itanium machines in the supercomputing center still here, but it's not particularly common. And when Itanium basically failed, Intel copied AMD64, and they called it eventually Intel 64. They're the same thing. They have different names, different people, and both Intel and AMD have manuals that document basically everything about how 64-bit x86 works, and they basically agree on everything, even though technically, you know, not officially in cahoots about what should be where. They just kind of copy each other whenever they add things. And these manuals are the definitive reference, and if you really need to know something, you should look it in the manual. Look it up in the manual. Now, I understand if you don't want to do that, because the manuals are kind of big. Here's the front page of the PDF. It might actually be, this is might be old, and maybe there's a 3E now, but you can see that it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 volumes. And you could, at one point, I'm not sure if you can anymore, get printed versions of these, and each of those volumes would probably be like a little softcover book. But they're available, and they document everything. Oh, so this size is probably... this is probably a few years old. I should have updated this slide. But they're big. But they have everything. If you see an obstruction you don't understand, this will tell you about the instruction. And that's useful if, like, we throw an executable at you, and you need to figure out, well, what does this do? You can figure that out. And I'm going to look at what the Intel manual page looks like. So here's the intimidating part of an Intel manual page for the instruction set reference part of INC, the increment instruction. And you can see that this has a bunch of information. So we have several different versions of the instruction, and we have the encoding. So this is the machine code. We will talk either later today or next time about how to read this, because you might wonder, what's this? What's this? We'll talk about that later. The FE here, that's hexadecimal, the byte FE in hexadecimal, the byte FF in hexadecimal, the byte 40 in hexadecimal. Then we have the instruction. This is an Intel syntax assembly. Not surprisingly, because this is Intel's manual. And the RM means a register or memory, 8 bits. Similar, 16 bits, 32 bits, 64 bits, and so on. So there's some other columns here. This op/en column goes with this table here, which is helpful for figuring out how to encode it, which will come up a little when we talk about figuring out this encoding. This 64-bit mode says whether this instruction exists in 64-bit in this format. And this compatible legacy mode is whether it exists in non-64-bit versions of x86. So there's one manual for all the variants of x86, 64, 32, 16-bit. This is, tries to cover it all. And so that's sort of how it distinguishes. So those are parts. And then below that, there's this description and a few other sections. So there's a description and the operation. So the description is sort of an English language description. There's also this sort of pseudocode, which I guess might be actual real code if you have an appropriate library for what the instruction does. A list of flags affected. Flags are the things that something like jump not equal uses to determine the results of the last comparison. It can be used by other things. And also a list of exceptions, which is how can the OS be called as a result of this. For example, with this instruction, when it's accessing memory, the OS could be called if it's accessing invalid memory. That's going to be listed in the list of possible exceptions. And yes, they do this for every single instruction that accesses memory. It's one of the reasons why the manuals are so big, is that there's this kind of redundancy that they have to mention every single time there's an instruction which can trigger basically a seg fault. But because they're like thorough about that, this is the definitive source, they generally don't omit details. So questions about our manual page here. Another reminder is, you've hopefully seen before, this is sort of the general purpose registers plus one sort of not general purpose register on x86-64. We have this weird overlapping register, so we have RAX is a 64-bit register, and EAX is a name for the bottom, the least significant 32 bits of that, and AX is a name for the least significant 16 bits of EAX, AL is a name for the least significant 8 bits of that, and AH is a name for the most significant 8 bits of AX, and so on. And we have this for all the registers. In some cases, the naming is maybe a little tricky to guess, like BPL versus DL, but this is it. Like, the naming, you can look it up. I'm not going to have you memorize it, but want you to be familiar with it. This diagram also shows this IP for instruction pointer, which is the same thing as a program counter, if you're familiar with that name. It's the address of the current instruction, typically actually the address of the end of the current instruction. So it's not actually a register you can write to, you know, you can write to it with something like jump, but it's not something you can write to in a normal way, but can be used like a register, sometimes to read from. And you might ask, how would you know when? Well, you'd probably see in this instruction set reference a case where RIP comes up in some way. Okay. That, and this is something I mentioned in 30-30, so apologies for those who remember it, but just mentioning how these overlapping registers work, because it might come up when we're like dealing with assembly. Is that if you set a 32-bit register, so if we set, for example, EAX here, the instruction might look like it's setting EAX like this instruction here, but it actually writes the whole register. Whenever you set a 32-bit register, it sets the whole 64-bit register. So when AMD was making their 64-bit extension of x86, they said, oh, we want all the 32-bit instructions to write the whole 64-bit register, just zeros in the top. But that's not the way the decisions that Intel made when they went from 16 bits to 32 bits. So writing a 16-bit register doesn't change the rest of the 32 or 64-bit register. And that's just a choice that was made. And our second assembly thing that's very duplicitous with 3330 is going to be about assembly syntaxes. So generally, I'm going to show AT&T syntax. This is because, you know, this is going to be the default for Linux x86 64 tools, and that's what our assignment are generally going to use. So I'm going to show AT&T syntax assembly. Intel has their own syntax. The biggest difference you can see here is that our destination changes places. And the second biggest difference you can see here is that we have this very, we have this different syntax for memory addresses. You can look this up as you need it, but I just want you to be familiar. The biggest thing is remember where the destination is. If you don't know that, things get really confusing. So, destination last. Some other things which come up is in AT&T syntax, constants always start with a dollar sign. Something without a dollar sign is a memory address. Registers always start with a percent sign. Something without a percent sign is a label. And also, operand length is notated by adding a postfix on the name of instruction. So Intel calls this instruction move, and puts the word quad. So in Intel syntax, rather than having this Q here, they write it's a Q word pointer in order to indicate the size of the thing being moved. In AT&T syntax, it's you. There's a variant of the instruction name to provide that information. So questions about in AT&T versus Intel syntax? My sort of brief going over this. Okay. One other thing that is duplicitous with 3030 and maybe 2150 is I want to mention LEA. So LEA computes a memory address and stores it somewhere. I'm mentioning this because you're going to look at this and say, oh, we're reading memory at this location, but actually we're computing this address 4 plus REX, storing it in REX, and it doesn't matter if this actually is a valid memory address. And, you know, in Intel syntax, this would be something like LEA REX REX plus 4. And again, it adds 4 to REX, it computes this address, which is this address, and stores the address, not the value at that address, in the destination. And you might see this used for arithmetic, which is why I'm mentioning it. It's because when you're looking at some code you want to exploit, and you're like thinking, oh, this is a memory address, you'll get very confused if you don't realize maybe it's not a memory address, might be, might not be. You need a little more context to figure that out.
Could you repeat, wait, what the LEA does? I mean, like, yeah, what is it? What's the purpose of this instruction?
So question, what's the purpose of this instruction? So
yeah,
it
yeah.
computes a memory address and stores it in the destination, and the computing a memory address is just arithmetic, and the instruction doesn't care if you actually use the result as a memory address, but it reuses the processor's machinery to compute a memory address for, you know, that regardless of whether it's a real memory address. Does that make sense?
Yeah, okay, thank you.
And, you know, sort of one justification is that, you know, we have this really flexible syntax for specifying memory addresses and instructions. This allows you to use it without actually accessing memory at the same time. Okay. So since we're reviewing a little assembly, here's a question. So the question on our LEA example, I'll get to, which is the parentheses donate the reference. The parentheses mean that this is specifying a computed memory address, but in other commands, that memory address would be used to access memory. In LEA, the address is just used directly as the result. So basically, yes, it's the parentheses donate a reference in other commands, but that's not sort of how I would describe it. So we have this question here. So we have an assembly snippet. We have this string. This specifies in memory A, B, C, D, ASCII character A. As a byte, E, F, G, H, and a null character at the end. And I'll give remember dollar sign represents constants, so I'll give the helpful, so the Intel syntax for this is move RDX string, and for the first one is move RAX string without brackets. I guess while I'm at it, I'll do some more translations. This is move into give another 20 seconds or so. So my start is this first move makes RAX point to the A, the beginning of the string. The second move copies 8 bytes, the size of our 64-bit register, into RDX. This is an 8-byte long value A to H, so that's going to be what's in RDX, it turns out. So, and we can go on from there. Okay, so we do not have consensus on what happens here. So I'm going to go through step by step about what happens. Let's see. So RAX points to A, RDX after this first line here, RDX points to, contains a copy of the characters A through H as a single 64-bit number. Then we move from, move 1 byte, that's the B, also the size of BL is 1 byte, RAX, so that's going to take this A here and move it into BL. Then we take 1 plus RBX, compute that value, and move it into EBX. And RBX is something which contains BL. So this ends up computing 1 plus A, which is going to be B, presumably, into EBX, which also RDX contains. So we end up with, rather than BL containing A, BL contains a B. I probably should use a different color. So BL contains a B after this, because this is A plus 1. There's also some other stuff in RBX that gets added to, which is going to mean that these upper bits of RDX might contain some junk, but it's not going to matter, it turns out, because we only care about BL later on. We never use the rest of RDX in this assembly snippet. So then we take that BL, which is B, and move it back into what RBX points to. So this B here gets copied back into that A, so that becomes a B. So the question is, why does moving something into EBX change BL? So if you remember when I talked about the overlapping registers, it turns out that BL is just a name for the lower 8 bits of EBX and the lower 8 bits of RBX. They're the same value. Does that answer that question? So two other questions. So question is, when we use dollar sign, it creates a pointer. So labels are equivalent to like writing out the address. So if this string, if this is say at address 10,000, then this is equivalent to move the constant 10,000. This is equivalent to move from address 10,000. So you can say that the dollar sign creates a pointer, but the way I'd look at it is the label represents the address, and if you're using it with a dollar sign, you're using the address as a constant. If you use it without, you're using it as an address to actually access. Another question is talking about this LEAL. So this LEAL here, it writes to EBX, and it's which is a 32-bit register, and we're using this 64-bit register here. What's going on with that? So addresses in x86-64 are 64 bits, but for historical reasons, there are two versions of LEA. There's the a version that produces a 32-bit result and a 64-bit result. In both cases, because our addresses are 64-bit, a 64-bit address calculation is done. The difference is whether that's the whole thing is used or only the bottom 32 bits. In this case, we're only using the bottom 32 bits of it, but it's always a 64-bit address calculation because that's the size of our addresses. So, yes?
I just want a clarification again, I'm sorry. In terms of like the move Q string without the dollar sign, right? Is this, after that line is like ran through, right? Does the register RDX actually contain the string value ABCDEFG? Like that's the actual, like the bot, like that's in that register?
Or... So the question is, after this move, is this actual A through H string in RDX? Yes. Now, RDX is a 64-bit value. And there's multiple ways we can read those 64 bits. So, but if like if you use a debugger, you'll just get a 64-bit number. But the 64-bit number is the ASCII for A through H. Does that make sense?
Okay. Yeah. All right.
Okay. So, a follow-up question on this EBX being... this LEAL, could, the question is, could this be an LEAQ? If we wanted to change this to an LEAQ, an LEA with a 64-bit result, we need to change the destination register to something like RBX instead of EBX. And that would have a different effect as far as the upper bits of the result, whether they're stored or not. In this case, it doesn't make a difference in this code, but in more other cases, it might. So then there's a question. Can I clarify, talk again about this string versus string? So some people might find it easier to look at the Intel syntax. So this dollar string is, take the address string, and we use the, we write string, but we really mean the address, and put it in REX. This is take the address string. This here is move from memory. So we could also have written this, and maybe that will make it less confusing, is like string plus, we could also have like done, not written this, but we could have done something like string RAX, RDX. This is to do string plus RAX, move from memory at that location. So people often think of these parentheses as representing accessing memory, but that's not how AT&T syntax works. The way AT&T syntax works is that if there's no dollar sign, it accesses memory. If there is a dollar sign, it's a constant. So this is unlike Intel syntax, where if there's no square brackets, it doesn't access memory, otherwise it does. With AT&T syntax, if there's no dollar sign, it accesses memory. The parentheses don't do it. So this is a memory access. So in Intel syntax, we use square brackets. This is not. And in both cases, string is just the location of the string. And in this case, because we don't have a dollar sign, we access that location. Hopefully that clarifies things. Okay. And there's some questions about the later instruction. So I kind of stopped at this LEAL. So we have this case where our, we now have a B in the beginning of this string here. BL contains the character B. RDX still contains a copy of the original A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, because we haven't, that's what we copied into there. And REX has a pointer to the beginning of the string, which is now a B. So that's after... So then we have this final instruction here, which takes RDX, this A, B, C, D, E, F, and moves it into 4 plus RAX. So RAX is a pointer to the beginning. If we add 4 bytes to that, we get an E here. So this is 4 plus RAX. And we move A, B, C, D, E, F, G there. So we get A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H. copy to there. So our good answers, I think, based on this are either A or something else, because the string maybe gets longer. Or not A, sorry. C or something else, because the string gets longer. So questions... question is, wouldn't this break the string because the backslash zero is gone? Yeah, so that's a concern. We don't actually know what's in memory after here, so this might not be a null terminated string anymore. That still falls under something else. So there's a question, LEAL does not clear upper bits, but LEAQ does. It would be the other way around. LEAL will clear the upper bits, and it's the same kind of example, I guess I don't have an example, as here, that that if we did a, that this move L of dollar negative one, which is the same thing as the 32-bit constant into EBX, is going to clear the upper bits, whereas a move of a 64-bit move into RBX will, you know, that's a 64-bit constant that will set all the bits of RBX. Bits, you know, copies from constant to upper bits. So it's the same idea, except instead of a constant, we have the computed address, which is this 1 plus RBX value. Does that answer that question? Okay. Okay, so we went over sort of tracing this assembly. So something we're going to have to do a bunch in this class is look at object on output, and I'm going to show a bunch of that. So I just, you know, this is from minus minus disassemble of some Hello World program. And this shows assembly, and I'd like to talk a bit about the format of this so we aren't confused. So this line here, we have a big number and these square brackets and a colon. This says there's something, a symbol usually represents a function, could be something else, but something named in assembly with a label. So think label in assembly at address 1060, called main. And within that we have instructions, and each instruction we have a line with the address of the instruction in hexadecimal. If the executable or library you're looking at is loaded at a fixed address, this will be the memory address. If it's loaded at a variable address, this will just be an address that's consistent within the file, but may not be where it ends up being loaded. We'll talk later on about whether things are loaded at the same place, because this kind of comes relevant when we want to make memory exploits. After the colon is the machine code listed as a sequence of hexadecimal bytes. And followed by that, we have assembly. There's some things about this assembly which is produced from the actual machine code, which doesn't quite make it valid assembly for you to write an assembly file, and it's worth mentioning. So here, this is a call to put s at plt, and this 1050 is the address of the thing being called. And it's a hexadecimal address, even though in assembly you should have written it with an OX 1050 object on. Don't do that. I'm mentioning it because you might get confused by that when you're trying to write things. And this thing in brackets is the address this name that this corresponds to. And object dump will try to find a symbol at that address, but if there's not one, it will it might write something like, where does that PLT plus, you know, 15, which is saying, this is a call to 15 bytes after put s. I don't know what, have a name for the thing that's actually there. So another thing here is here we have this LEA instruction, which is an offset from RIP. This is the, remember that pseudo register that represents the end of the current instruction as an address. And there's this thing with a pound sign, sort of this comment that ObjectDump wrote. And what's happening here is that ObjectDump is saying, this address that will be computed here, the address of this, which is RIP, which is the current instruction plus F98 bytes, that corresponds to hex 20404, OX2004, and that is 4 bytes after this thing called IO standard and used. So questions about interpreting this output? Okay, so looked at object of output, we looked at assembly, and I mentioned for assembly these sort of definitive references. Another thing that has that came up when you learned assembly in 2150 was the calling convention. And I would like you to be familiar with the definitive reference for the Linux calling convention, which is, I've linked these documents from the schedule page. The System 5 Application Binary Interface AMD 64 Architecture Processor Supplement is basically the definitive document if you want to know how does the calling convention work when we're doing this, when we're passing doubles or structs. It's in here. Yes, it's not going to be easy to read, but if you really need to know, you can find that this way. You could also like write a program and see what your compiler does. Both are reasonable, but I want you to be familiar. Yes, there's some things written down for those corner cases. And just as a sort of summary here, you can look this up when you need it. Sort of the basic calling convention on 64-bit x86 is there's six registers used for the search six arguments. Then things are pushed on the stack. Return addresses are pushed on the stack. So the call and return instructions push an address on the stack for call and pop an address from the stack for return and jump there. And by convention, the return value goes in RAX. And along with the calling convention, there's a rule about sort of caller and callee safe registers. So caller safe registers are ones where you have to assume when you make a call, they get changed. So I just have a list here. You might think we haven't seen these registers. We'll talk briefly about them, but I'm mentioning them because in real programs, you'll find some of these things. And so, remember the caller-callee save distinction. This is should be 2150 review, is that if it's caller-saved, did I notate this wrong? Callee-saved, wow. If it's caller saved, you need to save it before doing a call. If it's callee saved, you need to save it because the person's function which called you might use it. And it's a good time to have a reminder about what the stack looks like. We're going to talk about this more when we talk about buffer overflows, because we're going to be very concerned about exactly what this looks like, particularly this part. But just a reminder that when you're reading assembly in x86, the stack goes towards decreasing addresses. That pushing something on the stack, adding something to the stack, decreases the stack pointer. And removing something from the stack increases the stack pointer. Also, as kind of comes up here, the first thing on the stack is where the stack pointer points to, not just below it. So when we make a call, we push the return address on the stack and jump. That means the stack pointer points to that return address we just pushed, not just above it or below it. So questions about sort of my very brief review of calling conventions, mentioning there is a definitive reference and the stack. Okay, so some other x86 assembly stuff which comes up. Some major topics are not going to be review, are going to be things you probably haven't seen in x86 assembly. I'm mentioning because when you disassemble real applications, you're going to find these things. So one thing is how floating point works in x86. So x86 has two ways of doing floating point. There's something known as x87 floating point instructions. So the history is that there used to be a coprocessor, meaning that you used to get two processors, one for the normal stuff and one for floating point in your computer. And these instructions were for that coprocessor. And then there are these SSE instructions. So these are vector instructions we mentioned if you took 3330 with me, which work more like you'd expect instructions to do. And these use different registers, which is why we're mentioning them separately. So XV7, this coprocessor, doesn't have registers that you're used to. It instead has a floating point stack. This is a separate stack from the normal call stack that's in hardware that has 7 slots. And, you know, if you run out of slots, it wraps around, basically. And for example, there's an instruction floating point load. In that case, this instruction will push the value loaded onto the stack, onto the floating point stack, making the floating point stack at 0 contain that value, and moving all the other values down the stack. And if there was a stack 7, this 11 you cared about, you know, goes away. So we're not going to deal with this much, but I want you to know it exists, especially because otherwise you're going to look at assembly that does something like ST1 and wonder what ST? That's what it is. So we're not going to talk about it more unless you have questions right now, but it exists. It's essentially not used in 64-bit, fortunately, but it exists. It's there. You can see it's accessible from 64-bit because it's how long doubles work if you ever use those, but unlikely to come up. So x86 mostly uses these SSE registers, which are XMM 0 through 15, and these were originally designed to support vector instructions. So for example, here, this computes a result of 1, 2, 5, 8, 11, where we load 4 numbers, load another 4 numbers, add them together with one instruction. That's 4 pairs of numbers, and store them back in results. So this is what they are originally designed for, but these same registers are used for single floating point operations. And there's different instructions for that. So there's these registers, they're 128 bits wide, but if you're doing normal floating point stuff, you just use these instructions, which typically end SS for single, I guess. Scalar single instead of an array, or using a double, scalar double that just ignore 96 or 64 bit when doing the computation. And this is the code you see compilers generate typically when they're doing this. So for example, here I have a loop which does basically product times equals array of I. And the way this works is that this RSI here, which becomes that, that's array of I. Oh, sorry, this is not what I meant. This does, I've read this in the wrong direction. This does array of I times equals some value, and array of I is this thing RSI points to, which is loaded into XMM1, and this V is the value in XMM0, and this is the doing a single value at a time with each of these instructions. So this is floating point, so you know what it looks like. Sort of typical floating point code. In this case, these are the SS version, so it's floats. If it was SD, it would be double, and so on. So questions about how this looks? So that's floating point. Gonna mention addressing modes. So you've seen our constants. You've seen this general displacement-based index scale style. There's some other sort of things you might see. So I showed you this sort of RIP example, where RIP, remember, this is the address of the end of the current instruction. And you might see this used in this syntax in assembly, and this actually sort of translates as a way of writing of, this usually is actually sort of shorthand for thing minus current address, RIP. So it basically, that means that move queue thing RAX and move queue thing RIP RAX do the same thing, but the encoding is different. This is encoded with the offset, and this is encoded with the address of thing. We'll talk about this issue more when we talk about encoding, but you might see this syntax in assembly files where it looks like it's like using this label as an offset, but that's not actually what it does. It's kind of a special case in the assembler. So another thing is that we're talking about AT&T Intel syntax. Our jumps work a bit differently. Jumps look a bit different. They have this special star, which you can kind of think of as an extra dereference operation. Just mentioning that because it will come up when we look at some code. And I was going to do an exercise on that. I think I will skip over it for sake of time. Maybe we'll go back to it next time. So some other minor little things. So when we're disassembling binaries, you might see this NBR64 thing and wonder, what is that? This is a NOP instruction that marks the destination of branches. We'll explain much later in the semester why you would ever want this, but this is something that our compiler on Ubuntu 20.04 represents. There's a question, oh, I showed you this star thing here. Is this only for jumps? As far as jumps and calls, yes. It's only for things like jumps or calls. So another thing you'll see are string instructions. So for example, there's this move SB instruction, which moves one byte from RSI to RDI, and notice it doesn't take those as parameters. That these are just special registers for that. And where these most commonly come up are there are these prefixes to instructions like rep, which repeats an instruction decrementing RDX chosen just for this purpose until it's zero. So what this does is it copies RDX bytes from the address specified by RSI to RDI, incrementing RSI and RDI at the time. MoveSB moves and increments, really complicated. So this is a very complicated instruction designed for manipulating things like strings. So rep MoveSB is the most common. So this is basically a mem copy in one instruction that x86 has. And there's x86 has other instructions that kind of act like this. Like this instruction, they treat RSI and RDI and RDX as special. I'm not going to expect you to memorize how these instructions work. You can look up the details, but I want you to know they exist because otherwise it's really weird to see this and wonder what the heck's going on. Especially because you'll see it like this often, and it doesn't even mention that RDX is involved. So there are other variations of this. There's a load, there's load and store, sort of writing and reading things. And there's also versions of this that work not a byte at a time, but bigger units. And there's also some string comparison instructions that work like this. So I'm mentioning these exist because they're going to come up when you read assembly, not because we expect you to write them. And in particular, they come up a lot because even though these instructions, for the most part, are not things you'd ever expect to be included in a new instruction set, if you read the Intel manuals for how should I implement memcopy, this is what they recommend. And it may be the case that this is kind of special cased in the processor to be fast. So questions about these string instructions.
These all these special types, this is only just specifically, like even the other page that says load SB and store SB as well, that's only for the register RDX though, right?
The question is this load SB and store SB only for RDX? So the... Yeah. So if you use rep, it would be for RDX, but the actual string locations or values would be RSI RDI, but only those. Yes.
And that's the same thing. That's true for all those other instructions, those special instructions.
The question is, all these special instructions use these particular registers? That's my recollection, yes.
Okay.
If I really wanted to know, I'd read the manuals. Again, as I mentioned, I don't want you to memorize it, but I want you to not be surprised when you come across this reading assembly. Other... Okay, so one other feature I want to mention... is something called segmentation. So if you've taken 3330 or 4414, you've learned a bit about virtual memory, the idea that we set up this, that programs specify an address, there's this mapping set by the OS in these, typically these page size chunks, pages are like a couple kilobytes, that decides what that address means. and x86 supports virtual memory, modern systems, but there's also this pre-virtual memory scheme called segmentation, which x86 supports a version of. And in that scheme, addresses would be composed of an offset, which is what we typically consider an address, and a segment number. And each application that's loaded would have a table of active segment numbers. And each segment would have a base address and a limit. So the limit would be the largest offset supported, and the base address would be the real address in the real memory. And if you know virtual memory, you might say, this kind of looks like virtual memory, but with this added limit thing, assuming the segments in the address. But x86 has a version of this where the segment is kind of specified out of band, that our offsets look like our addresses, and you need a segment number for every address, and the segment numbers come from context. And the way it works in x86 is that if we're accessing code, it comes from a register called CS, which contains the current code segment. If you're accessing the stack, there's a stack segment register. If you're accessing data, there's a data segment register. And some of the string instructions, in fact, use an extra segment register, ES, and there's two other extras, segments you can use. And you can specify an instruction that actually I want to use a different than the default. So move would normally use the data segment, but you can specify that it should use the F segment, the extra, fextra, gextra, something like that, using syntax like this and some similar syntax in Intel syntax. And the way this works with virtual memory is that, we have in our program, we get this segment from the instruction and the offset from the actual address that's looked up in this table. We get this, what is called a linear address, and then all the virtual memory stuff you would know if you took 3330 or 4414 happens. So this is in addition to virtual memory on modern x86. So this segmentation is something that exists in x86. It's not used very much, but it has one, especially on 64-bit. In 64-bit, typically you could specify this limit. The limits are ignored, and the base addresses are ignored. So the limits are always the maximum, and the base addresses are always zero. So the segments don't do anything except specify some metadata about the program. Except for the FS and GS segments, which are ones you have to use by using this special syntax here. And for the FS and GX segments, this effectively gives you an extra pointer register. And Linux and Windows use this for something known as thread local storage. So if you have a program with multiple threads, one example of this is if you wanted one program to have shared memory but use multiple cores, you'd run one thread on each core. Each thread would have its own registers and run separately on each core. You might want that there to be variables that, are kind of like global variables but have different values on each core. This is a utility used for this, and the way they implement it is they set FS and GS to have different values on each core, and this lets you have that sort of pseudo-global variable without spending a normal register on it. So I'm mentioning this because you might see this kind of thing in assembly, disassembly, and wonder what the heck is going on. That's what it is. It's a thread local value. Okay. So questions about our segments, which I went through very quickly. Probably go to this diagram. So question is, shouldn't you be allowed to access another thread? Yeah, So what's going to happen when these are in use is that the address that you'll get computed here for, say, if this is, you know, FS, will be typically be an address that could have also been computed with the data segment. So you'll compute an address with the segment, you know, so this address here, this is probably another example, you know, could be other names for this address. Other ways of accessing the same value. Value without FS. And that will typically be the case for thread local storage. Does that answer the question of shouldn't you not be allowed to access? Right. Yeah. So typically these threads, since it's not a different threads can only access one thing, this is just a convenience way of different threads having, you know, having regions that are, they know are their thread, not that they can't access the other thread stuff. Okay. So I think I'm out of time for today. If you want to do an exercise, you can answer this question. And next time we'll talk about x86 encoding briefly, and then look at an example of an old virus and how it works, and talk about, you know, how that has to have evolved when we've gotten to sort of more recent systems. So I'll just take questions before I sign off. Otherwise, and reminder that there is a quiz. Yes.
Can you answer a question about the first homework right now?
I can. I'll first answer the quick question. Is the quiz open? No. Yes.
I've been trying to set up the virtual machine, mm-hmm. and basically I get to like the login screen, log in, and then it'll just give me a black screen for about 30 seconds and say that there's some kind of problem, log out and log back in. Do you have any idea what might cause that?
I do not. I would say, like, I do give alternate instructions for setting up the VM, which is one of the sort of emergency option. I'm not sure why that would be consistently happening.
Okay. It like chat might be saying it's also happening to them.
Yeah, so there might be something. It is definitely possible there's something wrong about how I created the VM. Because I wouldn't describe the infrastructure that created the VM as elegant. It's automated at least, so I can easily change things and redo it, but that's about it.
All right, thanks.